You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Apologies to those watching that I have these enormous purple headphones on my ears, which I'm sure is highly distracting. So it also it's also echoing in my head, like I might, because my ears are like sealed up, like I got seashells on them. But I'm gonna do my best to muddle
through.
That's
not, yeah, that's not good. I've been on TV before, where the minute you go on TV, you realize that everything you say is actually repeating or echoing in your ear with that little. And man, it is so hard to be coherent, let alone eloquent. Bill, you look like you are heading to like a rave to DJ.
Do they still have raves? Like to be?
I don't know, but you look like you might be on, I don't know, like ecstasy or something.
But like,
based on the era.
Like if I'm at a rave on ecstasy, is that like okay, boomer, go to your rave, go to your ecstasy.
I don't know when we hit the point where we can't be cool, but it happened at some point and here we are. I'd rather be in bed at like 8 p.m. anyway. So I don't need to go to a rave. We can have fun right here in the DMZ.
Now I see you got the stockings up. Is it full blown Christmas spirit in the Lewis household?
I am trying, Bill. We got the tree, we got the lights, we got the stockings. I'm listening to the Christmas carols. I'm not there yet. I'm not in Christmas mode yet. I'm trying to will myself into it. And by the way, maybe next week I have a really ugly Christmas sweater. So ugly that it's not even green and red. It's orange. It's an Oriole ugly Christmas sweater. And I'm hoping maybe we can trot them out next week and see who's
I don't have a great
uglier.
I don't have a great Christmas sweater. Maybe I should go to like the dollar store and find a Christmas sweater. So
you got DMZ, there should be the DMZ ugly Christmas sweater.
Now you say you're listening to Christmas carols. What, you know, what's like the number one or like the top five Matt Lewis Christmas songs?
Well, it depends if we're talking about the religious songs or whatever, the secular songs.
What do you want to listen to? Because I listen to almost strictly Christmas music or holiday music from Thanksgiving on.
I am kind of partial to like, I don't know, like the maybe like 1960s, like the original like Rocking Around the Christmas Tree kind of stuff. That's probably my favorite genre. It's upbeat. It's fun. But it's also now become kind of classic, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's traditional now. And it's also kind of fun. So that's probably my favorite. But look, I'm a fan of the whole catalog, Bill. You know, I like Charlie Pride. I grew up listening. Charlie Pride, who just passed away like last year of COVID. Has a really good and underrated Christmas album called Christmas in My Hometown. And half the songs are originals, half are like, you know, Deck the Halls and Drummer Boy. But that is, you know, that's one thing I break out. My wife, not as big a fan of it probably as I am, but that's one of the things I break out. And, you know, I'm trying to watch the movies this morning. I was watching It's a Wonderful Life, which is on Amazon Prime. I just watched The Bishop's Wife on Amazon Prime. I've been watching A Very Murray Christmas, which I love, the Bill Murray Netflix special. So, you know, obviously the Charlie Brown special that we own. So I'm willing myself there, Bill.
Charlie Brown makes my kids too sad. I can't watch them with them. They get too upset.
I like the second half, where he gets into the tree and the commercialization. And I like the first half, it literally is depressing. Mm-hmm. You know, he's going to Lucy talking about you're afraid of everything.
Right.
So,
well, I think I don't have my favorite Christmas songs fully ranked, but Fairy Tale of New York, The Pogues, Gotta be up there.
Now, wait. That song has some lines in it, Bill, that I think could get you canceled today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that would be a hard... You would... They would not... They would change the lyrics. I mean, they just wouldn't do it.
Yeah. I was disturbed to learn that there is no NYC... The boys of the...
NYPD.
NYC choir.
NYPD choir.
NYPD choir. So there is no... That doesn't exist. There isn't an NYPD choir. I was disappointed to learn that.
I did not know that. But even with...
There should be.
Even with the inappropriate words, I think it's fine in context because it's essentially showing neither character in the song are above board people. They both... I mean, Kirstie McCall is.
Starts off with him in prison, right? Yeah, like he's in the drunk tank,
and they're clearly both addicts and drunks, and this is not a love, not a great love story. So, I think you can justify it in that context.
Now the Bill Murray, Very Murray Christmas, they do that song, but they take out some of the more. You know, politically incorrect language.
I don't know, man. This cancel culture is getting out of control. You know what? Yeah. What song I really like. I know this is my top five, but I came across it later in life. I'm really enjoying it. The Bob Dylan "Must Be Santa."
Bob Dylan. I don't know if I know that.
Yeah, Bob Dylan has a whole Christmas album, most of which is just like straightforward, earnest, traditional Christmas songs. Wow. Like you wouldn't even know it's, I mean, it's got a gravelly voice, but you would never think Bob Dylan would do that. But Must Be Santa is more of like a snappy, catchy, almost polka-like number. That's a great song.
That is good. I'll have to check that out. It's funny how, these new, every once in a while, you'll discover like a Christmas album or song you didn't know. And then people keep, turning out. New stuff. Well,
I mean, I used to be a real aficionado of collecting Christmas songs, and now it's there's so many I can't keep up. Yeah, I'm also old.
Yeah.
But I feel like finding the nuggets is not quite as much fun. I mean, when I found like Root Boy Slim's Christmas at Kmart, it just felt like this this rare find. Or Dance Hall Crashers, I Did It for the Toys. Like those sorts of things just seem very unusual. Like now everyone kind of does stuff like that.
Yeah, Bare Naked Ladies had a good Christmas album. It's probably like 20 years old now. Going back to the shows, another one I recommend is the Andy Griffith Christmas episode. It's in season one.
How many times can we bring Andy Griffith into the show?
And it's on Netflix. it's a good. It's a very wholesome, good show, Bill. I think I wish that you. Would watch more of it.
I never, ever, ever liked Andy Griffith. As a young kid, I was always like, why did this show ever exist?
It's a great show, man. I can't believe it because you and I like other old shows.
I like 80s shows.
We have that account.
I don't like 50s shows.
Yeah. Well, sorry. Maybe if Andy, smoked weed, then... the episode, then maybe it would be cool enough for 80, your generation.
80 shows would show you why weed was bad. It would be the very special episode why you shouldn't smoke weed. But it didn't...
Do you like Ronnie Howard's other show, Happy Days?
I'm not a huge Happy Days guy.
I mean, you did a song, you did a parody song about the Fonz.
I mean, that's my finest, that's my finest work, but... I don't enjoy watching old Happy Days shows. I mean, I might watch a little here and there, but it doesn't quite.
Well, there is an episode where there's a pretty good Christmas Happy Days episode where Fonzie has no place, even though he's the coolest cat in Milwaukee, he has no place to go for Christmas. He pretends he's going to some relative's house that's going to have this huge party and this mansion, and Richie. And Tom Bosley, Mr. C, discover that Fonzie is staying in his little apartment, cooking on a hot plate. And so they come up with an excuse to like beg him to spend Christmas with them under some, you know, guys that they need him for something. Touching, Bill.
Is that the first time that Fonzie becomes more cuddly and becomes sort of a de facto son of Mrs. C?
Yeah, this is early on when Fonzie is still a little bit more rebellious and edgy before they really domesticated the Fonz. At some point, Fonzie's like teaching school or something. You know what I mean? Like,
that's when political correctness got out of hand, when they made Fonzie sanitize for the masses.
Yeah. But early on, the earlier episodes are better. And so anyway, one to grow on.
You're hardcore with Happy Days. So only seasons one and two.
Pretty much. And speaking of which, Bill, speaking of my kids and I, as you know, we've been going through The Simpsons on Disney.
As have we.
And we started off, you know, years ago, like 2 years ago when Disney came out, Disney Plus. And we've been watching chronologically. And I was always wondering, at what point will the show jump the shark and will I quit watching? Will I want to start over again? And I think we just arrived at that point.
So you're going through one by one.
Oh yeah.
Oh, my kids. My kids jump around.
Halloween. I'm skipping the Halloween episode, which I don't like.
My kids get scared by them.
But otherwise, we're watching every episode chronologically, and I think it's season 13 for me.
Okay.
To use a Happy Days metaphor, we have jumped the shark with The Simpsons.
That sounds about right. But my kids like the later ones, which I generally find, I mean, they're tolerable, but it's not the same.
Well, like, we watched one last night where, like, the first 5 or 10 minutes is about, you know, Homer buys Marge a koi pond, and then there's some sort of, like, rare caterpillar there that screams all the time, and the EPA won't let Homer get rid of it, which is like, okay, it's not Citizen Kane, but it's an episode. But then that transitions into something completely different that the caterpillar probably has never even mentioned again.
Right.
And it's just so random at that point. So,
I did think
I think we're going to start back over.
There's one that I watched last night. I think it's like season 20 or 25. The one where where it's Lego Simpsons. And that, I think, is a rare one in the later years where the show has some heart, where Homer and it's about the relationship between Homer and Lisa, that you saw more of that kind of emotional undercurrent in the earlier years. And they kind of, generally lost, where they become Homer is much more of a, you know, flimsy caricature. So I did like the fact that they kind of went back to there were some old school values in that one particular episode.
That's a good point. I think the show did lose its heart and quit trying. I mean, there's like the early episode where like Lisa gets a substitute teacher.
That's one of the greats.
I mean, and the funny thing is, I mean, just like your girls, like my youngest boy was like, oh, I like these newer episodes better. And I'm like, well, no, we're start, you know, I'm going to give you what you need, not what you want. You will sit here, son, and you will watch this season 2 episode of The Simpsons, whether you like it or not.
Okay, I think we've stalled long enough, Matt. We're almost at minute.
Oh, are we taping? Wait, are we taping? Okay. I thought we were just bullshitting, but okay.
Now, I feel like last week, well, we didn't talk about it last week, but I got the sense from you after the Supreme Court arguments that you're feeling pretty good about things.
We did a DM Zoom.
Yeah, we talked about it there. And I'm not,
well, we did talk about.
I'm not trying to do an abortion debate here. I just want to get at, I feel like looking at your column today in the Daily Beast about Trump meddling in Georgia, you're back in why is my party disintegrating Why are we off the rails again?
Life moves pretty fast.
Like the part about Trump that you liked, getting all the anti-Roe judges, like you had this fleeting moment of joy, and now you're back where you were, which is my party is being completely infected by nutcases.
Yeah, but I mean, I never said I'm going to vote for Trump because of the judges, or
you never voted for Trump.
I just felt like you got it. If I'm going to have to go through the downside of Trump, I might as well reap some of the benefit. You know, there may be might as well be something good that comes out of it, right? So, I thought the oral argument seemed to be very good. If you're pro-life, and I think that at the very least, the court will uphold the the Mississippi law. And possibly overturn the Roe Casey framework. And that's great news if you're me, but it does not have anything to do with how messed up the Republican Party is right now. And that is like very clearly, it is a disaster.
I mean, how
I see those things almost separate tracks even.
I mean, how is it that I thought that maybe after Glenn Youngkin won, here's a guy who won not by throwing Trump under the bus, but by running his own campaign with his own style, didn't do any joint appearances with Trump, basically showed the rest of the Republican Party, you don't have to be under Trump's thumb. You could run like a regular Republican and win in places that are fairly blue. I would have thought that perhaps more and more Republicans would say, oh, finally, we can start stretching our legs again and doing things the old way. We can't get rid of Trump, but we can contain Trump to some degree. But instead, you're seeing the insanity level get turned up to 11, where you have a needless primary for the governor's race in Georgia. You have Dan Crenshaw. I mean, Dan Crenshaw was fairly, pretty hardcore far right guy, getting dragged by Dan Bongino. Is that how I pronounce it?
Yeah. Who now has the Rush Limbaugh.
He's that. I didn't realize he was that big now.
At least he does on the channels that I listen to. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be like when Howard Stern went away and they mixed different people, different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. But when I turn on what used to be Rush Limbaugh, it's now Dan Bongino.
Right. And we've had the major and we've the Taylor Greene and Bear Bridge stuff, going on as well.
Nancy Mace.
Am I missing some primary action?
Did you see, by the way, did you see Nancy Mace's really, I think, thinly veiled attack on Marjorie Taylor Greene?
Which one?
Did you see this?
Which one?
So Nancy Mace tweeted, I'm going to see if I can find this. She tweeted, so Nancy Mace is the congresswoman from what, North Carolina, right?
South Carolina. Coastal South Carolina.
South Carolina. And she was, she got into this fight with Marjorie Taylor Greene. So she tweets out a picture. This is Nancy Mace of her with Carol Baskin. She says, Carol Baskin is up here this week talking big cats. We discussed animal rights legislation she's championing and more. And there's a picture, a smiling picture of Nancy Mace and Carol Baskin, which should send shivers down the spines of Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Because
a lot of people think, Bill, that Carol Baskin killed her husband and fed him to a tiger.
But what does that do with Taylor Greene?
Because this is Nancy Mace. Bill, you're so sometimes you're savvy, but sometimes it's almost cute. This is a warning, Bill. This is, do you remember like in The Godfather 2 when the guy is going to testify and then.
I never saw Godfather 2.
They bring it, they, Roger Stone is a, you know, has talked about this, but they bring in the guy from Sicily to just like sit in the audience and all of a sudden the guy forgets everything. Mm. This is a message.
Is it okay?
From Marjorie Taylor Greene. This is a very thinly veiled threat, my friend.
Well, let's get back to Georgia though, because how is it? I mean, here's a state that Republicans lost in humiliating fashion in 2020. One of the biggest coups for the Democrats to flip Georgia for both president and two Senate seats, giving them control of the Senate. And one of those Senate seats is up again, as well as the governor's race. And all available data suggests that the political winds are shifting in the opposite direction. Things looking good for Republicans. Democrats just barely won Georgia last time. So they got to tip back a little bit to the right to get that Senate seat back, which could well mean control of the entire Senate. And Republicans are choosing intra-party warfare just because Brian Kemp didn't steal the election for Donald Trump. And David Perdue is running solely on we can't stop Stacey Abrams because the guy that beat Stacey Abrams 3 years ago didn't steal an election for Donald Trump 2 years later.
Pretty much, yeah. That's pretty much it. Right.
After he signed a law that already curtailed voting rights to stick a finger in the Democrats' eye, and they're doing a gerrymander to take away a Democratic congressional seat. It's not like Brian Kemp is being some kind of pro-Democratic patsy, and yet Perdue is running on Brian Kemp is doing Stacey Abrams' bidding.
Yeah.
I mean,
So what Perdue is doing is stupid and insane, right? And but the point, the larger point is that this is going to be a tough fight because neither Kemp, so Kemp is obviously the incumbent governor. He is not going to roll over and let this happen to him. Perdue is obviously a former U.S. senator who has Donald Trump's support. And so this is going to get bloody probably. And meanwhile, you've got, you know, Raffensperger, who's in a, being primaried by another Trump loyalist. You've got Herschel Walker is the leading Republican running for Kelly Loeffler's.
Didn't even mention that insanity, because that's, again, someone who could throw away a eminently winnable seat.
So you've got, you know, again, these two, you've got a Senate seat and a governor's, you know, spot that both probably in Georgia should be Republican. And because of Trump, you are now in this situation where, like, Stacey Abrams, I don't think she had a shot normally in Georgia to be governor. But now, because of Trump, like, who knows? I mean, you could have a situation where Brian Kemp is bloodied and bruised, but he emerges as the Republican nominee. Half the people, the Perdue voters, won't vote for Kemp, right? Because Trump is out there saying the only way Kemp can win is if the election is rigged. And oh, by the way, Abrams might actually be better than Kemp. So you could definitely have another scenario, just like happened in January, where some Trump supporters just won't vote for the Republican nominee.
Now, I guess I have two questions. One, would it work the other way? So I agree with you that if Kemp's the nominee, diehard MAGA Perdue voters might say, screw that guy, I'm going to stay home. I mean, it doesn't have to be most of them, but I mean, Georgia is a pretty purple state. You lose a sliver of your base, that could be the difference. So any division has to give your heart palpitations if you're Republican. My gut would say if Perdue's the nominee, that the Kemp voters salute and get on board. I mean,
right, but you still have the scenario where he's bloodied and battered in a primary. And you still have a scenario where instead of nominating the guy who actually beat Stacey Abrams last time, you're nominating the guy who actually lost
to John Ossoff,
to Raphael Warnock,
to Ossoff.
Oh, sorry, to Ossoff. Right, that was in the runoff. So you're choosing a loser over a winner, and either way, there's going to be a bloody primary.
So that's my other question. I having watched the Kemp Abrams race and the Purdue Ossoff race, like putting all the Trump stuff to the side. Like, I think Kemp is a better candidate. I think he's a better, I think he's got more skills on the stump. He's got more charisma.
He's also more of a philosophical conservative. Mm-hmm. I mean, Purdue is actually more of a business country club Republican. Mm-hmm. Kemp is actually more of a philosophical conservative. So it's weird that, you know, when we had this whole world of like philosophical purity being the driving force for primaries, that it's really turned. It's now just loyalty to Trump.
I mean, for those who don't remember, Kemp ran ads where he's like, I'm going to round up the immigrants myself and put them in my truck. And I'm going to have my sister, my daughter's boyfriend over, and I'm going to point my shotgun near his face to make sure that he treats my daughter right. And you know, those ads were winning ads. You know, they hit a cultural chord and helped them win the primary and eke out the general election. And Purdue just seems like it's always been a very limp candidate. He's not exciting. Mm-hmm. So I guess
he's more establishment too. So like if they decide to like play who can out good old boy the other guy, Kemp probably is more authentically that guy than Purdue. Purdue's like a rich business guy. I mean, I'm sure they're all rich, mm-hmm. but Purdue is more of like a business establishment country club type guy.
I mean, if Purdue wins, it is strictly because of Trump. I find Trump's interference in these races a bit strange because they all come with risks of humiliation. And he's already backed, I think, a couple of candidates that didn't win their primaries. But they were, house level. They didn't get that much attention. If Purdue loses to Kemp in a critical swing state, that is very damaging to Trump's reputation.
No. It just means that Kemp stole the election. The election was stolen. And therefore, we can't.
And Stacey Abrams stole it.
Probably because she. That's brilliant, Bill. She wants to run against Kemp because she knows she can beat him. But it's already rigged anyway. If she could rig that Republican primary, she can rig the general election. So don't even bother voting.
But I mean,
it's a waste of your.
I mean, I take your point that hardcore Trumpers would see it that way, would never abandon their guy, but. The more rational Republicans in the established Republicans, the Glenn Youngkin Republicans or the wannabe Glenn Youngkin Republicans, you have to take, if Purdue lost, your takeaway has to be, this guy is not the ticket to the promised land. He can't win a primary in Georgia. I mean, he lost to Biden in Georgia. And he can't even win a Republican primary in Georgia. Why is he our guy anymore?
It would be so when Trump lost to Biden in Georgia, it was the first time since 1992 that a Democrat beat a Republican in Georgia for president. Like, that's the guy that they're worshiping. That's the guy that they think is their savior. Is the guy who all he does, if you're no. Trump has had some, surprising victories in other places and in 2016, clearly. But like in the context of being a Georgia Republican, Trump is not Trump is a problem for you, not a solution. He's a problem.
I'm not saying Purdue is destined to lose. He could well win. I'm just saying Trump's taking a pretty big risk by inserting himself this forcefully And I mean, I just saw a poll that when they don't mention Trump's endorsement, Kemp leads Purdue by a healthy amount. Then they mention Trump's endorsement, it's a dead heat. And of course, I think people will know about Trump's endorsement. So I expect this to be a close race. But a close race is a risk for Trump to stake his reputation on.
Yeah, but again, I mean, I think that he's prioritizing things like revenge, vengeance. And also, Bill, if you want to be, you know, conspiratorial about this, you know, there was that piece in The Atlantic about how January 6th was just a trial run. I mean, Trump is trying to methodically purge people who stood in his way from stealing the election, right? So he's going after Raffensperger. He's going after Kemp. He's going after the governor of Arizona. He's going after people who stood in his way when he tried to steal the election. Some of that could be vengeance, but there also is the chance that he's trying to get rid of them for the next time. The next time he tries to steal an election, there may not be these decent, good Republicans who, yes, they're conservative, but they believe in the rule of law. They believe in democracy. They may be gone, replaced by Trump lackeys. And again, it's hard to embarrass Trump because he's shameless. He doesn't have any shame, and he'll just lie and say, I mean, he'll say Purdue was, you know, Purdue was such an idiot, he let us down. Anybody could have beaten Kemp. Well, whatever. He'll have some face-saving line, and it will do its job of working with the people it needs to work with.
Now, the other thing that happened with Trump last week, this weekend, there's a report in Politico that he is involved in the North Carolina Senate race. He's endorsed Congressman Ted Budd, but he's been trailing the former governor of North Carolina, Pat McCrory. And there was a third person in the race, Mark Walker, the former congressperson. So Trump brokers a deal where Walker leaves the Senate race to run for a House seat and tries to do, and so Bud can go one-on-one with McCrory. But again, here's a case where Trump's guy is not the front runner. And the guy he's up against is a former governor, has run statewide before, has a reputation. I mean, and not a squish. He's not some centrist Republican. So again, Trump is inserting himself in a race where there's no guarantee he comes out looking good. Look, it's very possible Purdue wins and Bud wins. And if that happened, you'd say this is Trump's party, no question. But I feel that there's already a perception that it's Trump's party. You look at poll numbers, he leads Republican primary polls. His favorable numbers are very strong. Majorities in most polls say they want Trump to run for president again, although I think at least one poll where it's a plurality, not a majority. But the general assumption is this is Trump's party. And he's doing things that might make if they're wrong bets, make people say, wait a second, maybe it's not actually Trump's party. Maybe this is, you know, more bluster than is really true.
I mean, you know, this is not new. I mean, Trump isn't transferable. He doesn't drag Republicans down when he's not on the ticket or even when he is. He doesn't really lift them up. He doesn't really have coattails. And even Madison Cawthorn, remember, the super Trumpy guy, Trump endorsed his opponent like 2 years ago or whatever. So it's not a new phenomenon. I guess the question is, like, does there ever come a point where people aren't afraid of Trump? Where, like, he has lost so many times, and he's bet on the wrong horse so many times that if you don't get his endorsement, you're not scared. It doesn't bother you. Like, I don't think we're there yet. Like, even though you could demonstrate like statistically, that there's not a big correlation between getting Trump's endorsement and winning the primary or the nomination or whatever. There is still is a sense that you do not want to get on the wrong side of Trump, right? There's a fear of him. If that ever changes, it will be a big deal. I'm just not sure that accumulating evidence will get us there. I'm not sure why, but it doesn't seem to be the case that we're just a couple data points away from being able to show that there is no, the man behind the curtain isn't all that scary. Well, look, or whatever.
People are,
right?
People are going to have to make this. Republicans who want to run for president 2024 are going to have to start making their decisions right after the 2022 midterms. And maybe some might decide before. I mean, it's more traditional that you wait till the next election is done. But some people might be eager and antsy and want to get a head start. I think if anyone who's like on the fence, you know, can I run against Trump? Is there going to be auction for me? Is it worth trying and taking on that heat? If Trump loses primaries. If Trump-backed candidates lose their primaries or their generals, primaries would be more of a blow to Trump because that says that he's weak within the party. You know, that might make it more likely for, you know, Chris Sununu, who teased a run to make the jump, or some of the Senate people who are kind of Trump-ish, like Josh Hawley and Marco Rubio and Tom Cotton, Rick Scott. Glenn Youngkin might even start thinking about it if he's doing well. He's term limited, and Virginia's the one term limit for governors. So he might want to make that jump in 2024. Or Mike Pence. I mean, Mike Pence is clearly thinking about it. He's staying active. Maybe he's already made up his mind to take a flyer on it regardless of what Trump does. But it's certainly easier if Trump is wounded by the party's own base.
Yeah. I think the way to look at Trump's hold over the Republican Party is like almost magical. Like it's a cult. And I think his hold over them is not rational. And it's maybe there may be a point, there probably will be a point when the spell breaks. But I don't think that, you know, it's sort of like, you know, the Malcolm Gladwell book about the tipping point, right? I mean, you take an axe and you hit a tree. And at some point, and maybe it's the 100th swing you take, the tree falls over, right? But which chop was it? You know, you had to do the first 50 chops or whatever to get to the one that did the damage. So the thing is, the first swing you take, there's no reaction at all. It seemingly doesn't make any difference. Like the 20th swing you take, the tree doesn't move at all, right? It's not like it starts to tip over. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's nothing. And then the tree falls, right? And that's maybe how Trump is going to be, actually, which is like at some point, the spell will break. But it's really hard to predict, like, when that is going to happen. And it seems like it transcends, like, the rational or the logical, that it's, again, like a spell that has been cast.
Allow me to shift gears to the Democrats, because while Republicans are in their own circular firing squad, Democrats are still experiencing strife. There seem to be hopes for renewed party unity after the infrastructure bill passed last month. Progressives and moderates put their differences aside and got together. Progressives put some trust that moderates would be there for them for the larger Build Back Better bill. And that seems to be largely true, with the glaring exception of Joe Manchin, who, like, even though Democrats and Republicans are working through their differences, you know, they're getting the debt limit hiked, They're passing the defense bill. They're keeping the government open. They didn't have a shutdown when the funding was about to expire. But Manchin is remaining a holdout on the Build Back Better bill. And this week he's made several comments suggesting that he's not there yet. He's worried about inflation still. He thinks the House posts too many budget gimmicks. And he's not rushing to have a vote until he sees what the Senate parliamentarian does to it and what remains gets scored by the CBO, which all makes it hard to envision a vote occurring by Christmas. Not out of the question yet, but makes it harder. Are Democrats going to end the year on an up note? We passed our last big ticket thing. Are they going to end on a note of uncertainty and renewed intra-party tensions between progressives and moderates?
Yeah, I don't see them passing Build Back Better anytime soon. It seems like inflation and the jobs report have just the jobs reports that continue to mostly be uninspiring have just kind of given Manchin the permission slip to do what he kind of wants to do, which is to wait on this and drag his feet on this. Manchin's popular in West Virginia. I don't think there's any, we have to think of it from his perspective in terms of incentives. So I think Democrats can be happy that they passed that bipartisan infrastructure bill and maybe focus on what we have and not what we don't have.
But looking at it from Manchin's perspective, I don't understand what he's doing. I don't see why he needs a permission slip to delay. I mean, what has transpired through this year, culminating with the infrastructure bill vote, just clarifies that Manchin has all the leverage. He has all the leverage today. This bill will be, if it passes, will be Joe Manchin's bill. He will decide what's in it and what's not in it. He doesn't need to wait to gain more leverage. He has all the leverage now. Now, maybe his desire is to kill it in that sense. He's just going about the process of killing it. But again, he doesn't have to wait to do that. He can just say today, I'm not going to pass it, Democrats. Go find something else to do. Let's not waste our time here. Someone said to me on Twitter, well, he doesn't want his fingerprints on it. Well, of course his fingerprints are going to be on it. I mean, there's no way his fingerprints are not on it. And you're right that he can kill it and be just fine among West Virginia voters. So his incentive to pass is not to impress home state constituents. But chances are he's not running again. Chances are he did run
again. I don't know.
I mean, he could.
I don't know.
But it's more and more uphill for him in West Virginia. And so I would think he would probably say, you know what? I don't want to be defeated in my last election. I want to go out on top. Here, this moment right now is the moment where I have the most power that I or almost any senator could ever have. So why don't I use that power to pass legislation that will be my legacy? That'll say, I did this. And whatever he wants, he can get in this bill. And progressives are at a point where they have basically, tacitly admitted, we'll do whatever you want. We said $6 trillion and $3.5 trillion, and as soon as you said no, we said all right, whatever it takes, I'll do what you want me to do because I want to pass something. So I would think that the rational play, I mean, we're late enough in the game where they probably can't get a vote by Christmas. Maybe there's a way, but you could at least say, Manchin, Schumer, let's have our deal. Let's show what our deal is and what it looks like. And yeah, we'll do CBO and parliamentarian, just like the House had to go through their motions too. But we know what the outline of this deal is, and we can go home for Christmas feeling good that we're on the cusp of doing, of having a great year. We're not going to end the year with Democrats in disarray year-end stories. We're going to end with, through all the difficulties, Biden came out with, you know, a real gangbusters year legislatively, thanks to good old Joe Manchin. That makes the most sense to me. I don't see him doing that.
Yeah.
But there's still time.
I think part of it is that he's like inscrutable. Like I don't know. I don't think he, just like Sinema, they don't clearly, and this could be by design or maybe by accident, I don't know, but they do not actually clearly tell you what they're going to do or what they want exactly.
Well,
you can try to read between the lines, but I don't know that they have given us enough clues to figure it out.
Well, I think that inscrutability has served them extremely well all year, because as much as progressives tried furiously to gain their own leverage and counter their, you know, inherent leverage by having the determining votes, by being inscrutable, that just made progressives and other Democrats scramble. What do I got to do to make Joe Manchin happy? What do I got to do to make Kyrsten Sinema happy? Do you want this thing, this thing? And Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin will be like, well, I'll pocket that concession, and I'll just sit back and wait for you to give me more. So, like I get that. But again, we're at the point where that strategy has worked to perfection, and you have all the leverage. All right, you don't need to sit back anymore. You can just come down from the mountaintop and say, I need you to do this, 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 and this, and then we can move forward. And everyone's going to say, yes, sir, Joe Manchin, and it would be done. So I don't see the point of waiting anymore. Get it done by Christmas and have a nice holiday.
You know, it just may be that Joe Manchin agrees with me that we spent too much money, trillions of dollars this year, and you know, maybe you could argue for the hard infrastructure that it was worth it, but now these social programs, with inflation where it is, I mean, I think you could argue that it's just too much money, and it seems like maybe that's kind of where he is.
Well, he hasn't said so exactly. Well, he did say that. I mean, he did say this to the extent that, therefore, I will not vote for this under any circumstances.
Right.
But he has said as much that is a big concern, and I don't think that is a rational concern. I mean, inflation is a concern, generally speaking. But as I wrote for the monthly a few weeks back, Biden overstates his case when he says Build Back Better is not going to, you know, increase inflation, it's going to ease inflationary pressures. Well, that's true over the 10-year span. But the bill has its deficit spending front-loaded and its tax revenue back-loaded. So 2022, under the CBO score for the House version, has $155 billion in deficit spending. So deficit spending contributes to inflation. But we have a $22 trillion economy. $150 billion in deficit spending in that big of an economy is a drop in the bucket. That's not going to turbocharge inflation. So Moody's Analytics had their projection, right? So the last month we had year-over-year inflation at 6.2%, which was the highest in like 30 years or something or other. Moody's projected that without Build Back Better, by the end of 2022, we'll be down to 2.1% inflation. And if you pass Build Back Better, it'll be 2.5%. Either way, like, that's a reasonable amount of inflation when you're in the 2% range. Now Moody's is not psychic. They could be wrong. But I think that is a fair calculation. $150 billion or so is going to fiddle with that needle by about 0.5%. It's not the thing that puts you, like, way in disaster zone or way in the comfort zone. It's a pretty minor thing. And if that's too much for Joe Manchin, then fix it. Then go to Chuck Schumer and say, hey, can you take some of that tax revenue and put it up front? I mean, it's hard to cut the spending down because a lot of that spending is the child tax credit, which Democrats are very excited about. And that's that people are seeing the most. So yank that away is going to be politically challenging, though maybe Manchin wants to do that. But whatever it is he wants to do, just do it. Just make it the way you like it. And everyone will applaud.
All right, Joe Manchin, if you're listening, that's Bill Scherer's message, and you're welcome to come on the DMZ anytime. In fact, swing by. We'll do a joint DMZ. All right, Bill, another great episode. You need to go get an ugly Christmas sweater, and next week I will wear the ugly. I will beat you.
I'll do it again. I got my.
I will have the uglier.
I cut my tree. I cut my tree on Saturday.
Nice.
As real Americans do. I don't know how you're getting your tree this year.
My tree is up, man. My tree is up.
Did you cut it yourself?
I did not. I watched as some other dude cut it. That's emasculating me. As I sat back, smoked the Marlboro Red, and toasted him with my martini.
My younger daughter was really mad that there was no snow on the ground, but I'll tell you, it's a whole lot easier to cut a tree when there's no snow on the ground. And I also,
all right.
I also had my Hanukkah donuts this year. My annual Hanukkah donuts were a big success. And I did my first, I've always done glazed Hanukkah donuts. This is the first year I did vanilla cream filled and Nutella filled donuts, which are a big hit.
Sounds delicious. Mm-hmm. I could eat a donut right now.
You know, you can convert any time and get your Hanukkah donuts.
I'm down with celebrating, you know, the Jewish holidays as well.
Part of the Judeo-Christian tradition.
That's us, man. That's us. Those values. So no DMZ, no DM Zoom this week. We should talk. Maybe we can squeeze one in next week.
I can probably do a solo DMZ for my Patreon supporters.
Yeah, you go to patreon.com/BillShare and get in on that hot solo Bill action.
Well, we can talk next week, yes?
Yeah. Follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show, and we'll see you here next week.
All right, take care.
All right, thanks, Bill.